Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Footmarks podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find absolutely everywhere. And the title of this particular Footmarks is The First Great West Indian Batter. I'll give you guys a bit of backstory of how we came to this. I read Jared's chapter on the West Indies in his book, Overthrowing Cricket's Empire. And it was a hair-raising chapter, which I couldn't stop obsessing about for like a good week. And I messaged him right there and then that we have to record like this episode. And of course, it's on George Headley, who in the time that he played cricket, Jared was considered to be one of the best after Bradman. His numbers further solidify that sentiment, right? He scored 2,190 runs across 22 test matches with 10 tons and 550s at an average of over 60. And immense might not be a strong enough adjective here, right?
No, he was incredible. I think there's even a chance he's still probably, even with his numbers, is underappreciated because of how little people actually saw him. So, you know, obviously, even in the West Indies, you know, he was going from island to island. It's not like, you know, normal international cricket. We don't have a lot of footage of him in the way that we do of Hammond and Sutcliffe and Bradman, you know, other players of that era. And he sort of comes from nowhere and completely dominates in a way that I don't think any team has ever had a player of probably his level when they first started test cricket with the bat. The only ones I would probably put up there might be someone like Andy Flower. You know, like we just haven't had anyone like that before. And I remember looking up his first class record once, and it's worth remembering that a lot of the first class records of those test players from that era are quite often lower. And they're lower for a couple of reasons. One, they're lower because the pitches in first-class cricket were dreadful in those days. And two, it's also lower because you don't play because a lot of them were, like, English cricket was so strong. If you played first-class cricket in England, especially, you know, the way that a lot of the English players did, it would quite often be better bowling attacks than you might play in test cricket, right? Just because, you know, outside of Australia, that wasn't always the case. And you look at his first class record and he averages more. And it's like, I think it's like 9 or 10 more. Like, it's not even a small amount. Like, he just was such a phenomenal player who almost becomes a cricketer by accident at a time where it's completely amateur. Yeah. I don't know if we missed out on his peak, but we certainly missed out on a lot of his cricket because of the war as well.
And just on that note, sorry for interjecting, but up until World War II, right, George Headley had played 19 test matches. He played 22 in total, 19 came before the war. And if he scored, he did score 2,190 runs in total, 2,135 runs came pre-war in 19 test matches, right? His average was 66.71 at that point, and he was responsible for 26.5% of all West Indian runs at that point in time. So much like Bradman, you know, war did eat into some of his best years.
Yeah, and also, he probably shouldn't have come back. So, whether it ate into his best years, but it certainly ate into a period where he was going to make more runs. I think we saw probably his peak. Like, not saying that it wouldn't have leaked into, you know, early 1940s as well. But I think we saw the majority of his peak. But we probably didn't see him as the aging batter still starring. And I remember it was Zaltzman who was the first one who said to me, like, him coming back after the war. And he comes back from after the war partly for political reasons, right? Partly because he was the black champion of a side and a natural leader of a side that sort of needed that. And that's why he comes back. And he comes back and he's just not that player anymore. And it's a real shame at that point because it tanks his, because he only plays 22 test matches. Playing three poor test matches actually makes a dent in your record, right? Like, whereas if that was any other legendary cricketer, we wouldn't have had that. We would have just had them be incredible. So there's no doubt just how brilliant it was, just how brilliant a player he was. And we probably didn't see enough of him at his best. And then we also missed a big chunk of time when he was also great.
And those three test matches post-war not only made a, you know, somewhat of a dent, it was a sizable dent. You're talking 6 runs docked from his average in total.
Yeah.
You also mentioned his leadership abilities, of how he was a natural leader, but such was the air of racism and classism in the West Indies and the Caribbean at that point in time in history that, you know, they never had a full black captain or full-time black captain up until 1960. You know, I think Worrell was the guy who became captain in 1960. And Headley did captain the team once in 1948, which was again post-war. But that was more of a tokenistic gesture. So that's quite tragic, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it was, rather than just being tokenistic, although I think it was in a part, but there was also, if I remember correctly, when he captains in 48, and I hope I've got this right, they had rotating captains based on where the test was being played. So it's it even
island,
is more confusing.
Island politics.
Yeah, and we don't talk about that a lot, but the English cricket team also used to get picked based on where the ground was, the local authority. I would assume it was the county, but I can't remember exactly. But they would pick who the test was, and so you would get these bizarre selections, you know, where like random players would come in, or random captains might take over, or different batting orders based on what these people thought. So, yeah, he does, and I think that shows you the level that he was thought of. And there's always two ways of looking at West Indies cricket, and you know, within the sort of world of cricket, of sports politics, I would say, you know. Jackie Robinson is a huge deal in America, right? For breaking, you know, the breaking into the white sport of baseball and becoming a, you know, a black athlete. He's way after the West Indies. So do we go, well, we had a situation where you had Indian players playing for England, you had a black player playing for Australia, you had all these incredible things going on. South Africa, not so much, but you had all these, you did actually have these other things happening. And then we have a team that is largely black, like there's a combination for a while, but eventually becomes largely black and becomes known partly on the back of black players. Like, should we be celebrating the fact that we were so far ahead of everyone else in a sport where you had to be invited in as well, Bayram? Or is the other, but the other side of it is, yeah, but then you're saying that black people can't lead, right? And that's a very common thing, of course, if you go through American sports, where they've chronicled the leadership and the, you know, everything else. So the whole idea, I don't know if you know the history of basketball, but in college basketball, the whole thought process was black players were better than white players, but under pressure, they weren't very good. Like, there was always a caveat. And I think that's what we see with the West Indies. Whereas it's quite clear that I'm not sure George Headley would have been a good captain. What's the best way for it? I think there's a bit of KP in George Headley.
Uh-huh.
Right? A little bit. I'm trying to think of another player who's another good example of that. But a player who doesn't really understand why other people just don't go and do what he does. Right? He had that sort of Michael Jordan type thing of like, why is he just not doing all these things that I can do, right? But tactically, I think George Headley was an absolute genius, probably on a level reading the books and everything else, I think he's probably a tactical genius on the level of, say, Warwick Armstrong and some of the other early, you know, leaders, Jardine and everyone else.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, right? Because even in your chapter in the book, you mention how he was a different kind of human being, the whole KP thing, because he couldn't understand why other batters would play stupid shots. And he often questioned them, and I can never forget this, by saying something along the lines of, why him don't bat like that? I mean, what a character. And maybe that phrase is phrased that way because this is a guy who only knew how to speak Spanish for the early years of his life.
Yeah, I mean, if we don't have many great cricketers who were born. Wasn't he born in Colón in Panama or something?
He was born in Panama. We'll get to that.
Yeah. So, no, you're right. And I've seen him interviewed a few times. I think he spoke fluent Patois, Jamaican Patois, but I don't know if he spoke fluent sort of, what would you call it? Like a, you know, educational English in the same way. Mm-hmm. And as you said, he spoke another language altogether. It's a fascinating story that he became that good in a period of that time. But you're right. But also that, you know, what is it? Why don't he want to bat like that? Or whatever the phrase was, which is ridiculous. It really is.
Don't him bat like that?
Yeah. Why don't him bat like that? It's such a great phrase.
Oh, sorry. Why him don't bat like that?
and that is him. That's apparently what he would say at the non-striker's end, right? And so he's saying this to like the umpire and the bowler and everything. He could not understand why other people wouldn't just bat like him. And that's the thing I'm talking about, that sort of KP type thing. Mark Waugh, you know, there's a great story of Mark Waugh and Brad Haddon that I talk about in my book, of Mark Waugh saying to Brad Haddon, why don't you just hit the left arm finger spinner over cover? Like, that's the easy shot. And Brad Haddon going, What are you talking about, right? And I think Headley had that within him. And he obviously saw the game in that different kind of level, that sort of Bradman, like, even if he wasn't quite as good a bat as Bradman, he saw it on that Bradman kind of level where, you know, you see it very differently. And just to go through his record, just because it's not in the book, but I just want to talk about this. When he goes to Australia, he plays 13 first-class games in Australia and he averages 44. So his average holds up there. He's not great, but that's it holds up. 1933 is the first time he goes to England. He plays in 23 matches and averages 66. He goes back in 1939 and he plays 20 matches and averages 72, right? This is not just someone making a lot of runs on home pitches or anything else. When he went to and played on different kinds of wickets in different places, so we don't know how good he could have been because he only played the 19 test matches when he was in his peak. But we do know that he holds up. And so you can imagine a player of that level being able to work out Australian pitches and English pitches, even though he only went on three proper tours, right? He barely went.
Yeah.
But you can understand someone like him being like, wait a minute, just bat properly, dude. What's wrong with you?
Yeah. You also mentioned some other stuff in that chapter about what sort of approach he had as a batter. And he was an elite back foot player. That was one of his strengths. And such was his placement prowess with respect to shot making that he would purposely hit the ball to the bowlers in the deep, right? To intentionally tire them out. And then when he would face a spinner, first up, he would try to just slam the ball back at them with the intention to injure them. Now that is like proper supervillain stuff right there.
It's crazy, isn't it? And we know Jarvan Meendad has some of this sort of stuff too, but it's not, I've never heard of Brian Lara doing this, right? And Brian Lara is probably the best placer of a cricket ball in modern cricket. You know, the ability to hit the ball from any direction. Sobers was another one that you know, Graham Pollock. You know, we've had some great placers of cricket balls before, right? But then there's this, which is, and it's such a brilliant move because you're talking about him thinking about this in the 1930s, and it really isn't until the 2000s that John Buchanan comes along and goes, should we be putting our bowlers on the boundary? Like, we're tiring out our bowlers by getting them to, you know, jog 60 meters after they've just come into bowl. And then if they're at fine leg and the ball's hit the deep backward square, they've got to sprint for 30 meters and then jog back again. And it makes sense. So for Headley to put that into his brain at that stage, and you hear players say things, oh, we're going to run the opposition ragged, right? So it's not as if tiring out fielders is a new thing. And you know, Wilfred Rhodes talked about that, you know, when he was talking about cricket. But I've never heard anyone else say, that's where the bowler is. I'm going to hit the ball there. And as you said, then that other one, and I remember talking to this with a modern cricketer and telling them about, you know, coming down the wicket. He goes, well, that, you know, that how would he know which ball? And I said, well, you got to remember in those days, most spinners tossed the ball up. So he knew there wasn't going to be a flat ball. It's not like facing Adil Rashid and having to worry about the slider coming in. You know there's going to be a ball tossed up and you know you should be able to get to it. And he's playing it in a controlled way, right? He's not just swinging wildly trying to hit it for six the way that maybe Trumper would have or someone else would have. He's literally like, I'm going to control this as hard as possible and try and hit it dead straight. So he's probably hitting half volleys or full tosses straight back. And as a spinner, the worst thing that can happen to you early when you're bowling spin is that the ball hits your fingers, right? You know, you're trying to loosen your fingers and your wrists and everything, and you've now got a sting out on the way back. Again, it's just absolute genius. Like, I love the idea of that. And the skill to pull that off is something that we don't see that much. And it's that the combination of those two things. Like, he's clearly not if you average over 60 in test cricket, you're not a normal batter, but he's clearly he was clearly seeing the game on a different level and able to execute in a way that other players weren't.
Yeah, definitely an elevated level, especially for that time. But just to come on the skill part, of course, you mentioned his away record, which definitely holds up, more than holds up in England, I would say. And, you know, in contemporary cricket, or at least these days, we are currently speaking about how Yashasvi Jaiswal's first four tons have all been 150-plus scores, right? Well, George Headley's first 650-plus scores were all hundreds, and two of them were daddy hundreds, including a double. The top score was 223. So he scored 10 tons and 550s in test cricket, which means that his conversion rate was second only to Bradman, which I find fucking insane.
And that is why Nasser Hussain decided to bowl first at the Gabba. And this all, of course, reminds me of Hit Wicket, which is a mobile cricket strategy game that is all about making those tough decisions. Who do you want to send in as an opener when the asking rate is climbing? Do you go for the big hitter or the steady accumulator? Me, I like to throw in someone a little bit unorthodox, a bit of a wild card like the general. That keeps the opposition guessing. And what about the bowling attack? Do you unleash your express pace early or hold back for the death overs? I'm always tempted to bring on a mystery spinner in the middle overs and just try and break a partnership. Hit wicket puts you in the captain's chair. You draft the squad and select the batting order and even decide when to use those game-changing abilities. Do you burn your 2x ability to chase down a big total or save it for a critical moment later on? It's strategic, it's addictive, and it's more nerve-wracking than facing a Shoaib Akhtar bouncer. Give it a go. Download Hit Wicket and see if you've got the tactical nous to win. Yeah, I think, and I think that goes back to the comment that we said that he would say at the non-strikers. And Bradman would say things like that as well. Like, Bradman wasn't quite as blunt with it, but he would say, you know, why is it gone out? Like, he's set. Like, you know, I don't think they saw the game the same way that the rest of us do. So during this book, I talked, when I was talking to Barry Richards, and he said, oh, have you seen my conversion rate? And I said, no, I haven't looked at it. He said, oh, it's terrible. And I was like, why is that? And he goes, I get bored. Once I dominated and I knew the team was in a good position, I would get bored, right? And I would go out. And he said, like, you know, you could see, if you go through my record, when we really needed a big score, I would make a big score. But if we didn't need a big score, we just needed 70 or 80. And, you know, we're 170 for one. I'm off. I'm done. Mm. And I was saying to him, don't you think it's a skill then for players like, and he brought up Lara, to be able to go on in a situation, and he said, no, they're just being selfish. And it's a really different way of looking at it. And we know lots of cricket fans who would agree with Barry Richards in that, but it's a really interesting way of looking at it of, you know, Bradman always said the first 50 was hard, and then after that you should be able to make as many runs as you want, right? And Headley obviously was very clearly of that school as well, of that's the hard bit. Lara would say, what was Lara's thing? Was it the first 20 balls, the first 30 balls, right, were the bowlers, and then the rest were his, right? And that's just a different way of seeing things, and I think a lot of batters look at it. And I remember talking to Abhinav Mukund years ago, and he was saying that when the big difference he got was when he got to test level, in first class level, you make a 50, and then you just double it. Right? Like, you know, if you get out, you get out. But generally, you would expect to double it because you're now facing the second, third change bowlers. The frontline bowlers are tired. There's probably only one or two. And he said, when he got to test level, the thing he found really hard was the second 50 runs because the new challenges came. But if you're Bradman or Headley, it's like playing first class cricket, right? Yeah. Because you're so much better than everyone else. And so then the only thing that matters is motivation and, you know, being able to repeat the same skill over and over again. And you talk to tennis coaches who've coached, you know, tennis champions, and they'll tell you that the big thing is not finding someone who is really good at playing the shots. It's finding someone who will day after day go out and practice them to make sure that everything is repetitive, because that is the boring thing. And the thing about batting is for Headley and Bradman, it is boring because they are so much better than everyone else. Most players, like that sort of Mark Waugh, Barry Richards type player, do get bored and they do look for other challenges and they start to artificially come up with things, right, that they have to do. Headley is that other level of person who manages to just go, no, I am very good at this one task. And once I am in, I'm going to do that task until someone removes me from doing that task, which is much more like Bradman or Tendulkar. Those sorts of guys are like, no, we will bat forever. We will just, this is our crease. You know, the whole Steve Smith thing of like, no, this is my spot. This is where I'm going to be. I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, that hunger for runs is what kind of exemplifies him. I'd be really interested, actually. I'm actually going to ask Farun to dig up his match factor, right? Because if he was such a dominant player of his era, then his match factor must be through the roof, really. But anyway, we've talked enough about, you know, his mindset, the sort of person he is, his genius, really, and his execution of skills. And I'm really fascinated also by the fact that he's someone who obviously had a very complex way of thinking about the sport and approaching it. But for him, he kept it really simple. It wasn't rocket science for him, right? Like, he was just out there to do a job over and over and over again and kind of relied on that muscle memory. And I feel like those are the sort of traits that make someone stand out.
Yeah, and I also think that being an outsider to cricket, like, not that he was massively an outsider to cricket, because, you know, he still obviously grew up in, you know, spent a lot of time in Jamaica and everything else, but he wasn't from cricket in the way that, you know, Garfield Sobers was from cricket and you know, Don Bradman was from cricket. There was an element of him coming in from a different viewpoint and everything else. And, you know, I know in those days, especially if I think I'm right in saying that there was a lot more movement between the islands perhaps than, but perhaps than there has been of recent times because of the way that trade worked and everything else. So he has a background in a couple of, is it Trinidad and Jamaica is his family is from? Is that right?
I think it was Barbados and Jamaica. It was interesting, right? Headley was born in 1909 in Panama because both of those, or both of his parents were actually working on the Panama Canal project, which kind of puts another layer of history onto the story. And then it was actually in 1917 where an eight-year-old spectator, George Headley, who was viewing a game of rounders, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is a variant of baseball and is still played in Ireland. I think I'm right.
Rounders, well, you can play rounders, which there's two versions of rounders. There's one that's a little bit more like cricket and there's one that's a little bit more like baseball. So there are versions of rounders that you play. Well, when I grew up playing rounders, we grew up with a mini cricket bat. So we don't know which rounders he was going for, but rounders is one of those other sports that shares ancestry with baseball and cricket.
Well, I mean, he was viewing that game. He was 8 years old and then the ball was hit towards him and an eight-year-old George Headley, he leaped towards that ball and plucked it out of thin air with his right hand. Yeah. Now, the players who were playing that game of rounders, they were so amazed by this young kid that they asked him to play the next game. And Headley responded by saying that he'll have to ask his parents, which is very, very cute. But that was probably the earliest sign of George Headley being an absolute prodigy. Because, I mean, I have an eight-year-old at home who is scared of the ball, right? And this was someone who was clearly God-gifted. I'm not saying he didn't put in the work, but there is a bit of natural talent over there as well.
And there probably has to be, if you're going to be one of the best batters of all time and you don't grow up in a cricket culture from a young age, right? Like, as you said, he obviously thought about the game. So we don't even have to worry about that. But he's going up against someone where, you know, think about the amount of cricket that, you know, your nieces and nephews and my kids and, you know, any kids in, you know, in our sorts of environments are given, right? And have as a, you know, because we like cricket, because we are part of cricket countries and everything else. To think that he was able to develop without that, I think shows you that there was his hand-eye coordination, if nothing else, was probably on a different level to to other people's. And obviously that eventually comes out very strongly later on when no one can dismiss him.
Yeah, and as he, you know, grew up in Panama and only spoke Spanish at that point, his parents then sent him to Jamaica, wishing for him to eventually go to the USA and pursue dentistry. So that was his story. And he did go to Jamaica, and that's where he discovered cricket, right?
Yep.
Now, George Headley worked part-time jobs to fuel that passion. Such was his determination. And he even played as a wicketkeeper at one point without gloves because, you know, the facility couldn't afford that. Like, such was his talent. Mm. And then here's the fun part. At 18, he was set to travel to the USA to pursue dentistry. And there was a delay in his visa, which meant that he could feature in two games versus a touring English team. And he goes on and scores 71 and then 211 in those two games. The rest is history. And I can't think of a more iconic butterfly effect moment, right? That's what it is.
Yeah. And also, like, you think about that at the time, he probably might have had a better economic future if he'd become a dentist in America.
It's a massive risk.
Right? Like,
huge risk.
West Indies is just becoming a test nation. No one knows if there's any money from it. And Constantine is trying to go to America. He's trying to go to England and play club cricket at that point, right? Like, there's not a lot of money in it. But I suppose also there would be a lot of, like, you know, Jamaica is a small island and wasn't particularly well known, like, you know, because cricket wasn't particularly well known and they weren't picking up their sprinting gold medals at that stage or anything like that, right? Like, I think that's that next generation where I think the athletics really takes over. So they're not really known for all that much. And so he probably is a celebrity within Jamaica and he's got the choice of going off and being a dentist or being a celebrity in Jamaica. And he picks the thing probably he liked. Like, I mean, I've never worked on people's teeth, but I can't imagine it's fun. I don't think.
Hey, my family is a family of dentists, and they wanted me to become one. And I was like, you know, I like good teeth, but I don't like bad teeth, and I don't want to go near them. And it's too delicate a job for my hands.
I don't know how many people have ever looked in someone's mouth. Like, if you really look in mouths, they're not ideal, are they? Like, I don't
know. Especially if someone is. if someone is visiting a dentist, you can bet your money on the fact that that mouth won't be looking any good.
7 or 8 hours in to my day, I think I'd be thinking to myself, I'd rather be on a sticky wicket going up against some fast Australian bowler. So I think it is an amazing thing because he isn't as steep. I know his family were obviously part of cricket, as in they were from the islands themselves. So he's not like he's from Panama. There is an element of he's maybe not as steeped in cricket traditionally as perhaps other people had been. Would have been an easy decision for him to be like, I'm going to go be a dentist and I'll be fine in the United States. And he goes a different direction. I've got his match factor. This is his rough match factor here. So the averages, and while we're on a podcast, I can't deduct it 100%, but the averages of the top six players in the test matches he played is 35.49. And so he averages 60. So my guess is he's somewhere around 70% better than the other batters in the games that he plays. Like that is... It's slightly more than that, but I'm saying, I'm guessing it's around that because I'd have to take his numbers out to have a look. So it does tell you just how dominant he was on pitches. You know, this isn't a guy who just happened to luck into 19 flat pitches in test level.
And I mean, when I read all of that stuff in the chapter, that's why I was so wowed that I was like, this can't wait. This needs to happen. We need to talk about this guy on Footmarks. And it's interesting how, you know, when the West Indies first defeated England in a test match, which went on to become a test match, right? Because things were all cloudy back in the day. George Headley was one of the main protagonists. And even if that English team was a side full of has-beens and old cricketers, regardless of all of that, Headley remained a vital cog in the first West Indian team, which overthrew the empire.
I mean, what an incredible thing to... grow up as the child of people who who built the Panama Canal, and then beat England, and play so well in a sport that, like as I said, it was really weird that the West Indies ended up with Test status, considering the political state of the world and everything else at that time. And then at least on paper, he's certainly a better bat than Andy Flower. Where you end up with them, because Andy Flower was tested in a few more places and everything else. So, you know, but we just don't see test nations come in with players of that level. In fact, even when they've had talent like that before, like places like New Zealand, even Pakistan, they've lost their star players really early on for, you know, sleeping with an actress or going over to play private cricket in the UK. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and they had George Headley available to them through that early period, which meant that you had to bowl around him, right? Like he's literally locking up one end in test cricket. That really is such a important thing. I want to ask you something actually. So what's he known as?
As in his nickname?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
So his nickname is the Black Bradman.
Oh yeah. I mean, I should have guessed that actually, because everyone is the something Bradman at that time, isn't it?
So it's a weird one because like there's an element of that's quite a respectful thing to say, right? Because, like, you're not saying, I don't know, you're not saying he's the Black Tippy Hendren or Patsy Hendren, not Tippy Hendren. You're not saying, you know, even a normal player. Like, you're comparing him to the best of the best. But it's also there's a racial element to it. As you said, there are more, is it Sahir Abbas becomes the Asian Bradman?
Yes.
You know, there was the Kenyan Bradman, Steve Tocolo. Like that name has been used. Yeah, that name has been used before, but it's an interesting one because there's a level of respect for him in that nickname, but also to modern ears, it does feel a little bit like I grew up watching a basketballer. There was a white basketballer called Jason Williams who was this incredible point guard in the NBA, and he played more like a black player than a white player. So the black players called him White Chocolate, and it was like that's just what everyone called him. And then I was watching a podcast the other day where he was talking about it. He goes, yeah, I probably wouldn't be called that now. And so but there is a level of respect in those nicknames, right? They are not derogatory. They're the opposite, right? Of literally saying, you know, but it's a weird situation to be in. And, you know, I know CLR
also,
James.
Also, sorry, just one thing over here before I lose it. He's probably the only batter to be given the something Bradman moniker when Bradman was still playing.
Yeah.
So that's something unique, you know?
I think that's more amazing than it happened at the time. I think you're spot on there. CLR James always said that, and I don't know how much cricket Sorry, not how much cricket. How much Bradman and CLR James would have seen. But CLR James kind of, he always thought that Headley was looked down upon compared to Bradman. And it's like, yeah, but even if we take him at his best, the average 66, and Bradman's still a third better than Headley.
Yeah.
But there is an element of, I wonder where you know, he would fit in if he came through in a generation where, you know, the racial boundaries weren't so stark. Like, I'm not saying racism died when George Headley's career finished or anything like that. But if you look at the way that Headley, sorry, if you look at the way that Sobers, Richards, Lara are talked about, there is certainly a development in the way that we talk about players from that era. There might still be racial stereotypes that are used and all these sorts of things. But it would be interesting to go back and just wonder, you know, if we could have a look and just see if Headley was the second best, because you still had Hammond in that period. And Len Hutton plays, you know, sort of, you know, in a similar period. Sutcliffe was still playing. There's a lot of great batting in that, you know, 20-year block that Headley plays. And for him to be the person that has the word Bradman on the end of his name and no one else, I kind of feel like that's a level of respect. But I can also see why, you know, CLR James is looking at it as, well, he's not the black Bradman. You know, Bradman is the white Headley. Like, I understand that as well. Cricket media used to be pretty simple. Find your favourite newspaper, head to Cricket Info, and maybe a blog you'd like. Now just finding the best stories and writing is a huge challenge. You already have a job. You just want to read about cricket. Well, that is what the Best of Cricket is currently doing. They go out daily to find the newest cricket coverage and the best stories from any publication in the world. And when they can't discover what they want, they also hire some of the best writers to produce their own great stories. You can get the Best of Cricket via their website or on WhatsApp. They find cricket's best stories and give them to you every day.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you have a solid point over there. And I mean, you mentioned a lot of big names over there in Sobers, Viv Richards, Brian Lara. But there is a case to be made that none of those guys might have been Sobers, Richards and Lara if not for George Headley, because he's the first great West Indian batter.
Yeah, I think
he's the one who starts that supply chain.
Exactly. And I think the fact, and you could also throw in the captaincy as well. Like, he's there on the two most important things, you know. I think it would be interesting to see what would happen to West Indies cricket if they came in and they didn't compete straight away, right? So New Zealand don't compete straight away, but that's fine. That's New Zealand. They're a bunch of polite white people, right? Like, what happens if the West Indies came in? Because we saw things as well, like the West Indies bold body line, and we'll talk about that in another Footmarks very soon. But the West Indies bold body line, and, you know, they didn't have the political cachet, if you will, to be able to continue to do that, right? In a way that England did. England got away with it, just even themselves. Yeah. And so there were elements where the West Indies were sort of being hamstrung a little bit by the kind of cricket they wanted to play wasn't completely socially acceptable within the game of cricket. And then, of course, you have, you know, the old boy captains. It's worth saying, a lot of those white players, not just the captains, but a lot of those old West Indian white players were also really good players. Like, when I went back, I just assumed they'd all be like Mike Brearley and they shouldn't have been in the side. And there was a lot of good players there as well. They shouldn't have automatically been given the captaincy. No one's arguing that. But I do think they hadn't fully embraced their West Indian cricket, you know, the DNA that runs through the islands. And I know all the islands are different, but they all have their own, like, strand of cricket. And I don't think, you know, and I think in Headley, being the person he was and the way he was, and then being that dominant, I think that allows you as a cricket culture to be like, we don't have to play like England. We don't have to play like Australia. Mm. We play like the West Indies, and this is who we are. And, you know, and why don't he want to bat? Do you know what I mean? Like, that becomes a part of West Indian culture. And, you know, that phrase is something that you still hear variations of in West Indian cricket now. I remember Jimmy Adams saying it to me when I was chatting to him one time, and he was sort of saying a similar thing of, like, you know, why doesn't that guy just want to put in, right? Like, there's still that element of it. And Headley being a champion and being at that level is so important, I think, for the history of West Indies. And as you say, they go on to have three other great batters. And Headley is right. He might be as talented as those other three guys. We just don't quite have their body of work with him, but the bits that we know are undeniable.
Yeah, it's a fantastic anecdote, that one, the Jimmy Adams one, that such was Headley's cultural impact that you see that same sort of psyche resonating today still. Yeah. So just to kind of end this podcast, or before we do, in terms of, you know, cricketers who kind of put West Indies on the map, because there are plenty, right, in different eras, where does George Headley rank?
I think he's the first one. Obviously, he has a teammate who puts them on the map sort of off the field, right?
Yeah.
I think what Headley does is he's the first one that shows that they're not just there to make up the numbers, and that getting past a West Indies side is a legitimate issue, right? We're talking about this is not just another player. They are breeding players over there, white and black players who are really good, and then they have a great player on top of that. I think he cements the fact that West Indies are taken seriously well before India and New Zealand are. Not that they didn't have good sides and that they weren't coming through at certain points, but you couldn't ignore West Indies from day one. And Headley gives them that. And so by the 1950s, that the aura that he had and the respect that he had has now been earned. And so when that next crop of players come through, there isn't that sort of, you know, sometimes we see it like a new team come through even now. And they have a crop of players come through, and you see people online being like, yeah, but come on, it's this team. Mm-hmm. I think by the time the West Indies get good in the 1950s and obviously play really good cricket in the 60s and then the 70s, late 70s, they explode. I think there is definitely an element of knowing that Headley had come from there, you couldn't actually write them off as a team or as players. They've just taken seriously so much earlier in a way that India and New Zealand spent almost 40 years fighting to be, or 50 years really, fighting to be taken seriously. And it took India, you know, a good 30, 40 years themselves, right? And so that didn't happen with the West Indies because no one could get George Headley out.
Yeah, and truth be told, we've spoken about him for what, 35, 36 minutes, but this could be a documentary. It's such a terrific story with such amazing arcs and twists and turns and moments where, you know, things could have gone a different path. He could have been a dentist in America for all we knew. So it is really phenomenal, and that's kind of the essence of Footmarks. We tell stories over here that some people might not know of entirely, which is why I feel like it was a good one. But anyway, that does wrap up this episode of the Footmarks podcast. And just a quick reminder to all of you guys, you can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage. It can prove to be a one-stop shop for all the work that we do as part of this team, whether it be written content, videos, or podcasts. We'll see you soon enough on another one of these Footmarks episodes. But that is all for now. Have a good one, guys, and goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.